Are you tired of searching for great talk radio?
Something more important.
Search no more. We are the GCN Radio Network.
Welcome back to The Secret Truth. I'm George Butler. Charlotte Littlefield is off tonight. Welcome to our program, Tony Gosling from Bristol, England.
Got it, George.
Oh, Tony, thank you for being with us and staying up so late. We know that it's about 2:20 in the morning on Sunday morning in merry old England, is it not?
That certainly is. And as you know, George, I've been nagging you over the last few weeks to get...
Well, I tell you, lay it on us now, Tony. You've got some tremendous things to tell us. First, let me ask you a question. Where is the next Bilderberg meeting going to be held, do you think?
So I don't know. I would suggest we may be looking at one of the sort of main central powers at the moment, that is to say possibly even Israel and possibly the US. I think it's unlikely it will be here in the UK, particularly since the Guardian Online has been probably one of the biggest critics around the world of it as a newspaper here. So, you know, it's anyone's guess, I'm afraid. I mean, they love to keep us guessing, don't they?
Right. Tell our listening audience first, before we proceed, a little bit about your background, Tony.
Well, yeah, I worked in aviation for a few years from our family business, and then got into working in community radio in southeast London, and then got a job at the BBC as a researcher on the drive time show for the whole of London for the BBC. And that was quite interesting because we were doing all sorts of international and national stories. And as you well know, George, the media is very much centred in London. Everything is all the national news, all the international news is covered in London. And so we were doing quite a lot of that. So I did a couple of years of that, working with some really fantastic people who've gone on to great things in the BBC. But I mean, I found it was just impossible to continue working there because for all sorts of reasons, but mainly because you couldn't really do the difficult stories that they wanted, that I wanted to do. One of the things I was doing there, which was I found fascinating, particularly, was working on the IRA bombing campaign, reporting that to London in the early 1990s. Things like the stock exchange bombs. This was quite an experience in the radio newsroom, and it was a very lively newsroom. You know, where people would shout across the newsroom at each other, and I go into some newsrooms today, and they're like morgues, you know, which makes you wonder what on earth's changed in the world of news.
Right. What's this shocking new revelation about you and David Barnaby? What did y'all do? Y'all found out some stuff about the Bilderberg meeting, the first primary one, the first one?
That's right. Well, Dave, say something about Dave. He's retired. He's over 70 now. But he worked most of his working life as an engineer for Marconi, going around the world. Doing satellite earth stations, this kind of thing. So we've got sort of teamed up, really, looking at the Bilderbergs. One of the things that we've focused down particularly on this Operation Market Garden, which started on Sunday the 17th of September 1944. It was a massive airborne operation in Holland, the idea really being to go around the top of the Maginot Line and to penetrate right into the Ruhr area of Nazi Germany and to end the war early. And it was quite an audacious plan. But the thing that has really galvanized Dave and I together on this is the discovery of the involvement in this operation of two of the chairmen of the Bilderberg meeting. Now,
also, George, the first Bilderberg meeting took place in Oosterbeek, which was during the Arnhem campaign, called the Hexenkessel, which is the witch's cauldron, which was the pocket of British first airborne soldiers that were being hammered by the Nazis. This was the same place, the witch's cauldron, as the first Bilderberg meeting took place 10 years later.
As you also probably know, the big oil companies like Shell, what they were doing during the Second World War was really playing both sides. They had, you know, massive operations on both sides, and in Holland particularly was a sort of pivotal point. And Prince Bernhard of the Netherlands was very much involved in Market Garden. I hadn't realized this up until fairly recently, that he was actually involved in the planning of this big airborne operation, because this is King George VI, had placed Bernhard in what Whitehall Army planning staff, even after the Admiralty, that is to say the Royal Navy, had totally rejected, saying, look, this guy's an ex-Nazi. Prince Bernhard, who'd married into the Dutch royal family, was an ex-SS officer. And so, quite rightly, the Admiralty was saying, well, we really don't want him wandering around, the Admiralty buildings and being in any way involved in the war effort. So it was quite a surprise to find that Bernhard was involved. And at the planning stage, now, I don't know how much you know about Market Garden, but one of the most important myths to do with it in the film A Bridge Too Far is this idea that the Germans somehow managed to get the entire plans from a crashed glider. Although there's a bit of dispute about this, because no one's actually figured out that there was actually a glider with one of the headquarters that were landing that actually crashed. So this is a big question mark, and it does, the suspicion is that Bernhard was actually spying in Whitehall in the run-up in August and September 44 and passed these plans on to the Nazis. So that's the first thing. The other thing is the other person who was involved is another chairman of the Bilderbergs later, after Bernhard finished, who's Lord Peter Carrington. He was also the British Foreign Secretary just in the run-up to the Falklands crisis back in the 1980s under Margaret Thatcher. And Lord Carrington was a young captain in the Guards Armoured Division, driving a Sherman tank around in the Guards Armoured Division as part of the ground force, as Market being the airborne part of the operation. There were three airborne divisions, the 101st Airborne, which is an American division around the Eindhoven area, the famous 82nd Airborne Division, which landed in Nijmegen, and then the 1st Airborne Division in Arnhem. And on the ground troops, as part of the armoured column pushing up this what got then called Hell's Highway, right at the front of all that, once they crossed the Nijmegen Bridge, was Lord Peter Carrington. So interesting that these two were involved.
Right. I downloaded that site, that your article that you'd written, okay, about this. Also, there's a click-off in there of Captain P. Moffitt Barris of I Company, 504th Regiment. And that's a very interesting thing, that confrontation he had with Carrington, is it not?
It certainly is. I mean, this is really going to go down, I think. I mean, certainly it's one of the most important events in the history of the 82nd Airborne Division, was this incredible daylight river assault crossing of the Vaal Canal, the Vaal River, at Nijmegen, because they were having all sorts of problems pushing up this Hell's Highway up. If you've seen the film A Bridge Too Far, you know exactly what I'm talking about, which is this road which went up to Nijmegen and then up to Arnhem, and the British were up at the far end, but the 82nd Airborne were in Nijmegen, and they hadn't managed to actually capture the road bridge. So the tanks had, there was massive battles and fighting going on in Nijmegen, but they hadn't captured the bridge. So Team of Fat Burries, who's still alive over there in the US, apparently he's not too well, but he's just going into a retirement home of some sort. But he explained to me just how he had this confrontation after having captured the other side of the bridge and the first of the British tanks going across. The most important thing to understand is that the Nazi commander in that part of the operation, whose height's Harmel from the 10th SS Panzer Division, had planned when the first tanks came across the Nijmegen Bridge, the British tanks, to blow the thing sky high. He had it all rigged with explosives. But as in the film, he presses the little thing to get the bridge, to blow the bridge up, and nothing happens.
Okay, we got to cut away. Tony, we'll be right back. Thanks for being with us. Be right back. We'll continue.
The GCN Radio Network, providing the world with hard-hitting talk radio. GCN. Great talk radio starts here.
Welcome back to The Secret Truth. I'm George Butler. And welcome back, Tony Gosling from Bristol, England.
Hi, thanks, George. We left the story, didn't we? Just as
continue.
As the bridge failed to blow up, the British tanks from 30 Corps from the Grenadier Guards. Actually, they're American tanks built in America, bought under the Lend-Lease or something by the Brits, had rolled over the bridge and met up with Moffat Burrys from the 82nd Airborne. And unbelievably, Moffat Burrys had just lost half of his men in this incredible river assault. Was sort of scratching his head, and he asked Lord Peter Carrington, who was later to become the chairman of the Bilderbergers, he said, well, why aren't you going down the road? Because, of course, they captured the bridge with the hope and the promise from the British commander, Brian Horrocks, that as soon as the bridge was captured, that the tanks would be streaming across it and up the road to Arnhem to save the day, because the 1st Airborne Division, who'd managed to a regiment of which had managed to capture the Arnhem Bridge, which is hanging on, as Moffat Burrys described it, by their fingernails. They had Tiger tanks surrounding them, flamethrowers, God knows what, but they were just about hanging on. But instead of that, Lord Carrington and his friends in the tanks decided to stop, hold that end of the bridge, and brew up some tea. And actually, the most interesting side of all this is that since this whole event with Moffat Burrys, what he did is he actually went over to Carrington, held his cocked his Tommy gun, pointed it to his head, and he said, "You get down that road and use a few swear words, or I'll blow your head off." And that, at which point, Carrington decided to go down inside his tank and locked himself in the tank and stayed there all night. But he was under orders, apparently, not to go down the road. Now, if he had, I think it's pretty clear that the whole entire operation would have, at least there's a very strong chance that it would have been a success. The Grenadier Guards and the Irish Guards mostly were free. That's up to 80 tanks ready to go. And as Heinz Harmel has told probably the best authority in the world right now on Operation Market Garden, that's Robert Kershaw, who wrote the book It Never Snows in September. He makes it absolutely clear. He says, the British made a mistake when they stayed in Lent. Lent is the little village on the opposite side from Nijmegen, which Moffat Burrys had managed to get across to. He says, if they'd carried on, it would have been all over for us. So this is the German commander at the time, Harmel, making it absolutely clear that this was a terrible, terrible, disastrous error. That really what Carrington was doing was ridiculous. So we've got this whole question about, you know, first of all about the courage of the people who were there, and secondly about the entire command of the ground side of that operation by Brian Horrocks. Now, another side to this is that Brian Horrocks left a letter, a mysterious letter, to be opened only after he died, which, as many people presumed, was about this whole incident, because this was one of the big questions of his entire life and his entire career in the army, which he left with a military writer called Leo Cooper, who's actually married to the famous writer Julie Cooper. And Leo is now not very well, he's in London, but Leo apparently then lost the letter. So there's a bit of a mystery behind this. But as you can see, you know, that's just one aspect to which Market Garden very nearly succeeded and very nearly ended the war early. The other side to it is that up in Arnhem, Johnny Frost and a guy called Major Tony Hibbert were hanging on by their fingernails. This is the British 1st Airborne Division at the bridge. And they managed to get through on the radio to the Commander Urquhart and Lathbury, who were the major part of the 1st Airborne Division, who were outside town, and made it absolutely clear to them that there was a clear route called Lion Route that they could get several companies through to the bridge on. And he got the unbelievable message back from Lathbury on the radio that no, they weren't going to do that. Now, I mean, this is just incredible to think that you've got a couple of thousand troops ready to go to the bridge, and yet the commander of it says no. I mean, I think that certainly the British command, Lathbury and Urquhart, had decided that the thing was going to be a disaster almost as soon as they'd landed, because they knew that there were a lot of SS troops around, and they decided they didn't really want to go into Arnhem. It looks to me as if there was you know, a kind of decision that they weren't going to reinforce the bridge. So either of those things, two things had happened, George. Either the up to 80 tanks made it down that road up towards Arnhem that evening of the 20th of, that's Wednesday the 20th of September 1944, or if the reinforcements had been sent as requested by Johnny Frost at the bridge at Arnhem, then I think we would have seen an end to the war. One of the spin-offs of all this, of course, is it gave extra time to the Nazis in order to get all of their securities, gold, etc., out of Germany to do their kind of rebuilding operation after the war, which was a massive operation spelled out very clearly by Paul Manning in his book about Martin Bormann.
Yeah, expand on that, Tony. Paul Manning's book on Martin Bormann, tell who are the Nazis? Are they still out there today? Tell us something about that.
They certainly are. I mean, they don't have swastikas all over them, but they're certainly there. I mean, Martin Bormann, Paul Manning, I don't know how much you know about him, but he was working for CBS News over in Europe during the Second World War. And one of the things that he was in his sort of end of his life that he wanted to make sure was laid down on the record was that Hitler's deputy Bormann definitely made it away to South America along the Vatican rat lines at the end of the Second World War. And he had a very specific mission, which was to create hundreds of corporations and to also launder all the Nazi loot and gold through Sullivan and Cromwell in the US, and with the help actually of Alan Dulles, and to really to rebuild the Nazi empire in a very secretive fashion through using these front corporations. And so that was a whole side of this which may explain the massive delay. I mean, I'm not saying this is definite, but certainly it's one of the spin-offs was that it gave the Nazis that extra few months in order to make sure they could get all their securities and some of the loot out of Nazi Germany to rebuild their empire in this kind of cult fashion after the Second World War.
Are these people practicing a kind of a sorcery or some kind of a master mind control type of system on us on the West?
Well, I'm not sure about that. I mean, certainly I would describe most of the problems we have in the world now as being caused by cults. I mean, the Nazis were quite clearly a cult.
How would you describe a cult, exactly?
A cult, first of all, it involves oaths of absolute secrecy, you know, on pain of death. The other thing is it usually involves some kind of worship of, or almost worship anyway, of an individual. Like, for example, in Freemasonry, you've got the master of the lodge, and each lodge has these masters all get together, and they have a master. So there's this very strict hierarchy involved as well. But the main thing, of course, is the secrecy and the swearing of blood-curdling oaths to maintain that secrecy above all else. And, you know, so it means really that there's no way that anybody that swore any of these oaths can be proper public servants, which is one of the reasons why they target a public office. You know, they will secretly make sure that their people are involved in many, many, many public pursuits, many public offices. So, you know, I think that's one of the big problems we've got in the world today. But, I mean, you know, this goes back a long way, George. I'm sure you're aware of that. I mean, you go back...
Right. I've been studying this for 25 years, and you're right on top of it. You really are stating some very accurate things.
I mentioned earlier on George VI, didn't I? You know, who made sure that Prince Bernhard of the Netherlands was placed in Whitehall in the planning of the biggest military operations towards the end of the Second World War. The Bernhard who later appears, you know, as the chairman of the Bilderberg conferences and also is disgraced in 1975 with his $1 million bribe from Lockheed. But, I mean, George VI was... I mean, there was an application in 1936, just before the Second World War, John Loftus told me, because he's seen the files, he's one of those people who's just seen all these files that no one's supposed to see, that Edward VIII, who abdicated in 36 with Mrs. Simpson, right at the beginning of the Second World War, actually tried to get through the front line into the Nazi territory. So imagine what propaganda coup that would have been.
Okay, we've got a second break. We'll continue that. Just a second.
America's number one source for independent talk radio for over a decade. We are the GCN Radio Network.
Welcome back to The Secret Truth. Welcome back, Tony Gosling.
Yeah, hi, George.
Hey, okay, finish your thoughts there for just within a minute there. They were trying to get through the lines, you're saying?
Trying to get through the lines?
Yeah, you said that there were some secret files that were being read after the war, and the abdication of your former king there.
This is Edward and Mrs. Simpson. They actually tried to get into Nazi Germany at the beginning of the Second World War through France, and they were arrested by MI6, the British intelligence, and then sent out to the Bahamas because, you know, that would have been a dreadful propaganda victory for Hitler to have the former abdicated King of England, plus his Nazi agent girlfriend, Mrs. Simpson, you know, talking on the radio right across Europe in English, you know, in rather, this rather posh voice. Of course, that wouldn't be entirely surprising because the British royal family, ever since the Victorian times, has been actually the Saxe-Coburg-Gotha family, which is a German family. They changed their name to Windsor towards the end of the First World War because it was a bit embarrassing to have a German family running Britain when we were at war, of course, with Germany. But, I mean, this does go back a long, long, long way, right back to medieval times. And I mean,
they've got everybody fooled over there, don't they, huh?
Well, I think that, well, not necessarily everybody. Friday the 13th, we just had one of those, haven't we, yesterday. Friday the 13th of October 1307 was the day when the French king, God bless him, Philip the Fair, arrested, did dawn raids on all the international bankers. Now, I think we could probably do with that today. They were at the time the Knights Templar. The Templars were then dissolved in 1314. And lo and behold, of course, they got a lot of their wealth went to Scotland. It's well known that Roslyn Chapel was a Templar chapel. In 1348, not long after, just sort of, whatever, kind of 40 years later, was the formation with Edward III of the Order of the Garter. The Garter Knights, basically based in Windsor Castle, supposedly, but they are 2 times 13 covens of knights surrounding the British crown, and they've been there ever since. So it's very difficult for, I think, for kings over the centuries to be really independent-minded when they've got all these knights surrounding them.
All these secret societies and everything. Okay, let's move on to Harun Aswad. What do you have on him? Was he involved in the 7/7 bombing?
Well, he certainly was.
Tell us about that.
Well, we know that he was in touch with all of the 4 alleged bombers in the run-up to the 7/7 bombings. But bizarrely, the British so-called justice system seems to think that it's much more important that he's sent across to the United States to face a trial there over some kind of looking for to buy some real estate in the US, which I just find absolutely incredible. Actually, what they've done is the judges in the European Court said, oh, actually, we think he should be held here because of his questionable mental ability. But then, of course, that would fit exactly with the kind of basket cases that MI6 love to recruit, you know. So it does look as if this guy simply was some kind of, you know, useful idiot that's been used by MI6 to make him think that he's going to be some brilliant jihadi or whatever. And 7 years on, George, I mean, this is unbelievable, isn't it? You know, when the Titanic sunk 100 years ago, this is a great little transatlantic link for you here, then you know how long it was until there was a public inquiry after that into what happened? 2 weeks. 7 years on from the 7/7 London bombings, when the most devastating attack on Britain, supposedly, since the Second World War, is 7 years on, and we've still not had a public inquiry into it. So, you know, you can see how things have actually got quite a lot worse in those 100 years since the Titanic sunk to do anything to do with justice. It means that future generations are simply not going to know what happened. We've had no proper public testimonies from those involved. And no.
Well, these false flags are being operated in many cases by the real elite power groups in these countries. Well, Gladio was being in Italy, it was finally uncovered, right?
That's right. Of course, we've had this incident recently in France too, but it's fascinating what's happened in France, George, because the public have figured out and the press has figured out that the guy, Mohamed Merah, who supposedly confessed to the police and then they killed him, He was an informant for the French intelligence services. So for a few days or a week or so, Sarkozy bounced up in the polls. He's now plummeting again as the French press and the French public realise that this entire incident has been a put-up job, and this guy is...
Tell us a little bit about that incident. Give us a little background on the incident.
Well, the incident was the shooting innocent of a rabbi and two Jewish children. And then days later, Mohamed Merah was fingered as the guy who'd done it. He was surrounded in a massive siege and then shot dead. So, of course, all of the entire story has been told by the French intelligence services. And now it's become absolutely clear that he was working with them. There have been denials from the intelligence services too. But this has really backfired on Sarkozy because it's clearly, in the run-up to the French election, some kind of attempt to get Sarkozy to go up in the polls, but it's backfired spectacularly. So, yes, you're right. These elites do try these tricks on, but it looks as if, that there is enough of a consciousness now about the way this kind of thing works to make these things more and more increasingly difficult to do. You know, this is one of the...
Oh, let me ask you a question real quickly about whether is England and the people there are waking up to this Eurozone problem and this money problem, and they've never really... they never converted over to the euro, have they? And so they've been very, very cautious about joining the eurozone totally. What's your view there about some of the leading political figures in England?
Well, I think certainly we've seen Cameron, haven't we, this week. He's over in the Far East. I'm not sure if you're following what he's up to, but he's going around the world doing arms deals to all sorts of, dodgy regimes. So, that's that side of things. But, yes, we are slightly insulated in England from, and Britain, from the euro crisis. But, I mean, I don't know to what extent the city of London can survive it. I mean, what we're dealing with now, with this whole cult-type situation, the cult of finance in the city of London, it's like the ivy is bringing down the tree. No longer are our enemies abroad. Our enemies are at home, and their greed is actually destroying the countries that they're supposed to be serving. Most people now in Britain will look upon the city and the bankers as the problem. And we've got this massive democratic overhang. So the main political parties have been controlled. Certainly at the very top, they're controlled. There's no real democracy in the main political parties here anymore. So when you get an interesting figure like former Labour MP George Galloway, he stood in a by-election up in the north of England. He gets a massive, massive majority with taking tens of thousands of votes off of the main parties with, some of the parties even getting derisory of just a handful of votes and losing the
basic British citizens are realizing how they're being manipulated, is that it?
Well, it's really difficult to know exactly, but I can tell you what, there's a great disillusionment with the political system. But this bothers me. If you combine that with the financial austerity that's slowly kicking in, with that selling off of our National Health Service, which has been really important for the last 30, 40 years, we are starting to go into a sort of 1930s-style situation where things are getting bad. Now, we've had riots, of course, because the young people are just simply copying the greed of the bankers by going and looting shops when we had the riots last summer. And the way is being paved for a new Hitler-type character, basically, so that someone like a Hitler could come along in the future and just sort of say, hey, guys, I'm going to clear things up for you. I'm going to be have a cultural revolution. We're going to make things wonderful. And that's the big danger, and also, of course, a big shift into extremism. This is one of the things we've seen, the rise of this organization called the English Defense League, which is actually a racist organization. And this is one of the things with Islamic terrorism, in inverted commas, has it been a new kind of excuse for people to go out there and be racist. So that's another difficulty. Social problems are rising, but, I see this as almost like a red carpet for a new Hitler. So that's the problem, I think, over here.
So there might be another Reichstag fire type thing, or 7-7 or something like that in the near future, you think?
It's certainly possible. Whether it's here or in the US or in Israel, one of these main countries in the English-speaking world, the sort of evil empire now, I'm afraid you have to call it, I really don't know.
Okay, Tony Gosling, thank you very much for staying up late there in Mary O, England, and Bristol, England. We certainly appreciate all your hard work your tremendous research over the years about Bilderberg and so on. And we thank you, and we'll have you back for sure. We certainly appreciate every interview we have with you. Thank you.
If you want to pick up on some of the stuff, it's on Bilderberg.org website.
Okay, we'll do it. Thank you, Tony.
Cheers, George.
Okay, cheers.
Hi, this is Ted Anderson. If you own an Apple iPhone and love to listen to your favorite programs on GCN, I've got good news for you. I'm proud to announce that GCN has a brand new iPhone app available for our dedicated listeners at GCNlive.com. Listen to your favorite hard-hitting GCN programs live or on demand right on your iPhone. And the best part? The GCN iPhone app can be yours absolutely free. Download the iPhone app today by clicking on the banner at GCNlive.com. Again, that's GCNlive.com. Hi, this is Ted Anderson. Have you ever wondered why banks, stockbrokers, investment advisors won't talk about gold IRAs? They've been available since 1986, yet the financial industry won't recognize the value of gold for your retirement. Gold has outperformed paper investments, yet no word about IRAs. If you would like to have gold for your retirement, call 800-686-2237. Don't get left behind by rising inflation and low returns. Call 800-686-2237. Secure your future and call 1-800-686-2237.